Hi, thank you. It's great to be here. For those of you who don't know me, I'm Susan Clark, and I'm part of a member of Yoshi Yamamoto's group at Stanford University. This work was done with the help of two postdocs, Thaddeus Ladd and Chang Zhang, as well as Kai-Mei Fu at HP Labs, and Colin Stanley at University of Glasgow grew our samples. And I'm going to talk to you about our experiments using optical spin echo in gallium arsenide. So one focus in the Yamamoto group at Stanford is the semiconductor quantum computer. And so there are several attractive properties that semiconductors have. First of all, thanks to our classical computer counterparts, there's a lot of previous knowledge in semiconductors. We know how to grow them pretty well and fabricate pretty well. They're pretty small. The ones that we look at have large dipole moments, so we can optically control them. So which we can also have very, and their energy scales are such that we can have very fast interactions. And all these things give us the hope that they're going to be able to, you know, make them into a scalable quantum computer, quantum system. However, there's always the problem of decoherence in these systems. These qubits interact very readily with the environment, and their environments are pretty dirty. There's lots of nuclear spins around, paramagnetic impurities, all sorts of things that cause problems that shorten the time. So example of this, in the systems that we look at in particular, the T2 star dephasing and the T2 coherence times are much shorter than the measured T1 times in the system due to interactions with the environment. And we're looking for ways to extend the T2 star and the T2 coherence times. So why have we chosen to try and control them optically? It basically comes down to speed. We want more manipulations before the decoherence occurs. And I'm going to show you the way we control them. We can do single qubit rotations in just a few picoseconds. And so why is the optical spin echo an important experiment? There are several reasons. One, we use it to measure the T2 time. So we're limited in our system by a 1 nanosecond dephasing time. And we know the T2 time is much longer than that, so we want to be able to get around that dephasing, and spin echo does that. And we use optical spin echo because since the dephasing time is 1 nanosecond, other ways of controlling these systems are a little bit slower than that, so we don't want additional dephasing time while we're trying to correct the dephasing. It's sort of a milestone. It's the first step towards dynamic decoupling using optics, which will spin echo itself decouples the spin from static environmental differences for your bulk system, and then if you can do an extended sequence, you can decouple your spins from systems from changing dynamic systems. So you can even extend your T2 coherence times even further. And if your goal is for a simple quantum computer, and you're doing your manipulations optically, and you can extend your coherence time optically, that might be able. You can have it all in one system, just optics and your memories, and then you can make it as simple as possible. So anyway, my outline is I'm going to tell you a little bit about the specific system we use, which is the donor-bound electron system. And then I'm going to walk you through a series of experiments that we did. And you can keep track of which experiment we're on just by the number of pulses that we shine on our system. So just as we shine more pulses on it, we learn something more about our system. It's great. And I'll finish with possible future work in dynamic decoupling. So the donor-bound electron system is, there's a lot of talk right now about quantum dots, and there's a lot of excitement about quantum dots, but we shouldn't overlook these systems, because these are very similar to quantum dots, and they have some of their own unique properties that make them interesting. So the specific system I look at is silicon donors in gallium arsenide, and at low temperature, we work at 1.5 Kelvin, they become an attractive potential for an electron. And if you put a magnetic field across that electron, that forms the basis for our two state quantum system. So it's the spin states of that electron that's bound to your silicon atom in gallium arsenide. And however, when we apply a 10 Tesla field, this is about a 50 gigahertz transition. And I said we're going to do everything optically, so we need an excited state that's connected optically to these two levels. And that's the donor-bound exciton state when an electron-hole pair, or an exciton, is also bound to this silicon atom. And you can, by absorption of photons and recombination of the exciton and emission of photons, you can go between these two states. And as I said, it has some positive aspects of atomic atoms is they're much more homogeneous than quantum dots. So it's basically just little atoms sitting in your semiconductor. That they're all the same, except for their environments are different. And unlike quantum dots, where they're different sizes, and it's difficult to find two that are the same. And it still retains many of the solid state positives, is that they're easy to fabricate and grow, they're small, and they have these fast time scales. And some specifics of the system that I'm working on is they're nominally undoped, so they're very spread far apart from each other, so they're not interacting with each other as we're trying to do these experiments. And based on our spot size, we're observing about 10,000 to 100,000 at once. So I work in bulk system, but there's work to isolate single ones. And the line width of these transitions is about 100 megahertz to 1 gigahertz, which is narrow for solid state, if you atomic people don't believe me. And so we use ultra-fast pulses to rotate our spins. But let me explain first. So a common way, if you have this three-level lambda system, in atomic physics, is you do a stimulated Raman transition. You have a laser on this transition and a laser on this transition, and you shine them both at the same time, and you can move, and they're detuned, you can move population from here to here without actually exciting anything to the excited state. And you can imagine if you make these pulses, you're using sort of long pulses, if you make them shorter and shorter in time, they become spread out, the spectrally broader and broader, until soon one pulse encompasses both the frequencies that you're using to perform your transition and many other pairs of frequencies that can also perform the transition. And what's interesting is that if you have your Fourier transform limited pulse, they all work together to rotate around the same angle. So a couple of things to note is the rotation angle of this effective Rabi frequency is proportional to the pulse energy, assuming you keep your pulse width constant. And the rotation axis that you're rotating on the Bloch sphere depends on the phase difference between frequency pairs. And so as I just mentioned in your Fourier transform limited pulse, the phase difference between frequency pairs is going to be the same for all of them. And then also for consecutive pulses coming out of your laser, there will also be equivalent. So in the lab frame, each of these pulses is going to rotate about the same axis. So you can get to any point on the Bloch sphere by using that rotation in combination with the precession around the B field, which in these systems we have a 20 picosecond Larmor precession. So you can rotate up to some point and then let it precess, and you can get to any point within 10 picoseconds. So if you could rotate all the way around. And there's lots of other groups that are working on this in semiconductors. And there have been lots of papers recently out on this work, including three from our group. So on to the experiments. I'm going to show a couple of these sorts of slides, so I'll show you how they work. These are the pulses that we're shining on our samples, so they go to the sample over here. And I call this a one-pulse experiment, even though there's sort of three pulses shown here. I just count these ultra-fast pulses in the middle. This is an initialization pulse. So we just do a optical pumping type thing where we put a laser beam between this transition and eventually all the population settles in the zero state. And so your Bloch sphere is oriented. I chose zero as down. Then right after the picosecond pulse, depending on the power of that pulse, you rotated some angle on your Bloch sphere and you've made a coherent superposition of the zero and one state. And then in your final optical pumping readout, we again just apply our laser beam at this transition, and we collect all the photons that are emitted at this transition that will be proportional to the number of donors that collapse into this one state that will show us how far up, how close to the one state we are on our Bloch sphere. So what we expected was when we would apply just a Rabi oscillation experiment, as you change the power of this pulse that you apply, you expect to be able to move your spin all the way up to Z and have it come back down, and you should be able to see Rabi oscillations. However, when we did the experiment, we modeled it using a three-level master equation, and we would expect, so we initialize to zero, and we go up to one, and we would expect it to continue like that. We saw that it saturated at about 0.5. However, if we included a term in our model that had a decoherence that linearly depended on the power that was applied, we saw that it fit our data quite well, and since there had been other success in other systems, it started to indicate that in this system it might be due to the free excitons, but we weren't exactly sure what was going on at the time. However, we did notice that at this area, the two curves seemed to line up fairly well, so there could be coherent behavior in this regime. So maybe low power pulses we're still actually rotating them coherently. It's just when at high power something else happens in our samples. So to test that, we did a Ramsey fringe experiment, which is the two-pulse experiment. How it works is after your first pulse, you rotated your spin some angle, and then you let it process for a certain amount of time. And depending on the amount of time you let it process, when you apply your second pulse, it'll rotate it to a different place. So if it's over here and it's rotating, since they always rotate around the same axis, it'll rotate it down. And if it's processed to over here, it'll rotate it up or someplace in between. So you should be able to see the Larmor precession of the spin in the XY plane as you scan the timing of this pulse. And I should also note that the combination of this pulse and this pulse are sort of show where your spin polarization is projected onto the XY plane. So as I just said, it should show, since it's processing around that magnetic field, it should show that precession. So when we did this experiment, we saw very nice fringes, and we could fit it with the model using the same parameters, the decoherence, the linear dependent decoherence, and these fringes indicated to us that we were coherently rotating the spins, but we were limited to low power rotation angles. So we did some calculations and saw that we could get a pi over 3 rotation with 0.9 fidelity. And then you could think about maybe if you needed larger rotations, you could apply a pulse, wait a Larmor precession, apply another pulse, and sort of do a cascaded rotation. But then the fidelity goes down. So here's a pi over 3 plus pi over 3. We have a 0.73 fidelity. Okay, so on to the spin echo experiment. For those of you familiar with spin echo, you might be confused how we're going to be able to do a spin echo experiment without a pi or a pi over 2 pulse. And those of you who aren't familiar with spin echo, I'll explain it at the same time as I'm explaining how we'll do it without the pi or pi over 2 pulse. So again, we start with our spins initialized into the zero state, and we're just going to do a regular Hahn pi over 2 pi over 2 spin echo sequence. So after the first pulse in the Hahn sequence, all your spins are rotated up by pi over 2, and in the small angle case, they're rotated by pi over 3. Just before, so you're waiting a long amount of time compared to the dephasing now, so they're all in slightly different environments, so they're all seeing slightly different B fields, so after a long amount of time, they're spread out over the plane, and that shows the dephasing. Then after your pi pulse, it rotates 180 degrees. In this case, it just sort of rotates your plane up, another pi over 3 pulse. And then right before your last pulse in the Hahn spin echo sequence, it's entirely rephased. And in the small angle case, it's rephased into a pattern that has a measurable spin polarization vector that will then process around your z-axis, which is the B field, which then you can measure here. So we do expect to be able to see some fringes, even though they're much smaller than what you would expect using the typical Hahn spin echo sequence. So, and when we did the experiment, we saw the expected fringes, and when we compared to just using two pulses of similar time scales, we saw no fringes. So that showed to us that when we put in that refocusing pulse, we really were seeing an echo signal, and that was pretty exciting. Here's at 78 nanoseconds, and here's at 500 nanoseconds. So if you plot the fringe visibility versus the pulse separation time, you see that it decays. It looked like that there was sort of a fast decay that went on and then a slower decay. And we believe we fit it with a phenomenological model where this fast decay is additional decoherence from the pulses themselves. So when the pulses are fairly close together, if the next pulse comes too soon, it'll just have additional decoherence that was from the excited decoherence of the first pulse. So that's this part of the graph. And then here, we think once the pulses are further apart, we're starting to see the real T2 time. And so if we fit it that way, we get an intrinsic T2 of 6 microseconds, which is similar to previous measurements in quantum dots, but most people don't look at this donor system, but it's a similar system, so by the Greylich paper. And then it's also supported by a nuclear spin diffusion theory, which is where you have we have spins flip-flopping inside the wave functions of these donors. And this is in this recent paper in PRL. And then in dynamic decoupling, you can continue even further if you could apply pi pulses faster than the fluctuations that cause decoherence, you can continually refocus, and then you can even extend the coherence time beyond this 6 microseconds or this microsecond time. However, for that, we would right now there's no scheme that I know of that can use small angle pulses for sort of these longer term decoherences. And so we either need a system with full pi pulses. So right now we're investigating the fluorine donors in zinc selenide, which might have some attractive properties because they we can put them in quantum wells, which splits off the free excitons further, which is what we think is causing the problems. Or maybe we could use some sort of cascaded pulses scheme to get up to a pi pulse, even though it's at a little lower fidelity. But or maybe someone will come up with a dynamic decoupling scheme that uses small angle pulses. So in conclusion, I've talked about a successful implementation of optical spin echo in a semiconductor system. And then these ultra-fast pulses are fast, but they do seem to induce additional decoherence in our system. And these donor systems are still promising, even though silicon gallium arsenide maybe not the way to go, but zinc selenide maybe. All right, thank you for your attention.